Just to remind you, the rules from yesterday, for those of you who weren't here, we're going to have a respondent's going to speak 25 or 30 minutes, then a response from the paper author for another 10 or 15 minutes, and we'll be open for questions for about 25 minutes. And we'll be using the finger hand for a new issue, finger for a follow-up point. The paper this morning is Kimberly Brownlee's paper, Striking Out, for the sake of the attacker. And the respondent, Lisa Hesch from the University of Stockholm. Lisa, you'll begin. We've got something on the board, so I'm going to come around.
So, thank you for your paper.
Do you want the microphone?
No, I should be fine. Thank you for your paper. I thought it's really interesting, and I also thought it's really nice that finally somebody cares about the attacker, even though with pretty bad consequences for the attacker. You start your paper with the assertion that it is part of morality to care about other people's well-being. And
excuse me, you're a little hard to hear.
Oh, okay. Is that better? You start your paper with the assertion that it is part of morality to care about other people's well-being, and that includes their moral well-being, and so we have reason to protect them from moral defilement. And then you turn that into an argument in support of harming an unjust attacker. So you say victims have two non-contingent reasons to strike out against the attacker. And the first reason is to prevent the wrong, which is an impersonally bad event, and the second reason is to protect the attacker from moral defilement. So the victim is permitted or warranted to act on those two grounds if she can do so at very little cost or at little cost to herself. And you also assert that sometimes we have reason to care more about the moral well-being than we have reason to care about autonomy. And from that you draw several conclusions. Your first conclusion is that there's a pro tanto duty to prevent an attack if the victim or a third party can do so with non-debilitating force. And then your second conclusion is that if that's not possible, so if non-debilitating force is not possible, there is still a duty to attend to the needs of the attacker, but the victim can choose between two suboptimal options. And then you extend your reasoning also to cases of self-attack, and you say that third parties have reason to prevent somebody from unjustly attacking or harming oneself. And finally, you extend your argument to war, and you say that your argument also applies to war at the collective and at the individual level. So from that, we can see there are very many points and interesting points in the paper, and I'm obviously not going to address all of them. I think, so especially I'm not going to engage with the question of paternalism and the question how we weigh autonomy against moral well-being, even though I think people would probably disagree with you on that point, but that might come up in the question session then. So that said, my comment is not so much a challenge to any of the arguments that you make, but more an attempt to clarify some of the issues that you bring up and in order to avoid problems or to avoid some ambiguities in the paper. These are the main points that I'm going to address, and I will explain what's on the board later. So when I was reading your paper, the questions that I had in mind was, why is this paper so interesting for us, and what are the new insights that it does offer? And you give an answer to that in your conclusion when you say that the paper provides us with new and different answers to the questions why we should act in self-defense and what we are allowed to do in self-defense. So if we take into account the needs of the attacker as well, we get different action guidance in some cases. And you give three very explicit implications where your account differs from other accounts. So firstly, you say your account helps to understand the difference between evil acts and bad events. And you use McGrath's example of being pushed off a cliff is worse than falling off a cliff. And you say that evil acts are worse because there's additional harm to the moral well-being of the attacker. So it's not just the harm to the victim, but also harm to the attacker. And I thought there might be a more intuitive way of explaining the difference between evil acts and bad events, because one could simply say an evil act is a rights violation, and with rights violations we always have the harm to the victim, so the content of the right is taken away, life or bodily integrity, but it's also disrespectful to the victim as a rights holder. So we have also these two dimensions, whereas in bad events we only have the first dimension. So that might be more intuitive, or more people would want to use that explanation, because caring about the attacker might not be so intuitive, but that doesn't say that possibly both explanations work, your and the other one. Then another way in which your account differs or might differ from other accounts is that in cases of the consenting victim, so you mentioned pacifists and suicides in many of your examples, and you say that even if they consent to their being harmed or killed, if they are willing to die or even if they desire to die, then they should think about the attacker as well. And so on your account, it's letting oneself be killed is less justified. And then at the end of your paper, you talk about the revisionist just war theory, and you say that contrary to their accounts, on your account, there would be some level of moral equality between unjust and just combatants. And here you say that if a just combatant commits an unjust act, the unjust side would also be permitted to kill in self-defense in order to prevent the just soldiers from being morally defiled. And here I think that actually revisionist just war theorists would go along and say if it's an unjust act, so if it's one that is not justified by liability or by lesser evil justifications or with one act which is disproportionate, then unjust soldiers, of course, they can strike back. So these are the explicit points in your paper, and I think that's quite clear. But then when I thought through the implications of your argument, I thought there's a fourth novel aspect, because I think notions of liability and the need for moral assistance are probably not always overlapping. So you might want to address the question, what do we do in cases in which the attacker is not liable but still in need of assistance, and what are we, all things considered, allowed to do in those cases? And that's the main point that I want to focus on. So I start off with the first point, the reasons for actions and the types of actions that you present in your paper, and that's basically retracing the argument again. So you start off by saying we have a wrongdoing, and on the usual accounts, after wrongdoing, the attacker forfeits rights and becomes liable to harm. So that's how we usually think about those cases, and you say, so you're not disputing the notion of rights for future or liability, and so I guess it simply remains intact, but you say it's very, very circumscribed, so one only is liable to harm in the moment of self-defense, and for the purpose of self-defense, other rights remain intact. And because other rights remain intact, you say that the attacker is still as a consequence of wrongdoing, the attacker becomes needy of moral assistance, or he or she even has a right to moral assistance. And that's the second dimension, and you say that's like a basic humanitarian right, and it's independent of the attacker's desert and culpability. Then from the victim's perspective, what follows from that is that the victim is permitted or justified to act because the attacker is liable, and as a consequence of the need for moral assistance, the victim is warranted to act. That's warranted is the term that you use, and that I'm also going to discuss a bit more at the end. Yeah. And you say if the use of non-debilitating force is not possible, then the victim has two options to choose from. Either the victim is warranted to kill to prevent moral defilement, or the victim can let herself be killed and then hope for or work for reform of the attacker. And you say that the victim is warranted to choose either option. But I actually think that these options are not on par, and we find in your paper, and I found some arguments to prefer the ex ante option, but there are also independent reasons. So in your paper, you use the Erasian conception of well-being, which you distinguish from his notion of self-interest, which is, as you say, a biological notion. And you say that on the self-interest notion, the length of life does matter, but well-being is more about the quality of life as opposed to the length of life. And I read again this paragraph of Ross's, and I got the impression what matters for well-being is the realization of goals and commitments and relationships and projects, and that to me actually looks a bit more future-oriented than the way you present him. But I guess there are other people who understand more about Ross and can say what he means by that. But even so, I got the impression that your view is kind of reminiscent of the Stoic view on death, or the Stoic notion of quality of life. So I had this quote by Seneca, who says we should strive not to live long, but to live rightly. And that seems to be precisely the idea that you're working with. So if we endorse that idea, then it seems we already have a strong reason to prefer the ex ante option to kill the attacker, because death will certainly prevent moral defilement, so ensure that the life is lived well, while reform is uncertain, and there is a chance that the attacker is either unrepentant or will have a miserable life. So we can actually kind of cross out that option. Or it's only the second best option. And then another reason why we should probably prefer the ex ante option is that, or it's suggested by an analogy to punishment and self-defense. So I think intuitively we think it's better to harm somebody in self-defense rather than letting oneself be killed and then afterwards punish the attacker. So punishment always seems to be only second best as opposed to preventing the crime, because punishment doesn't really efface the crime, and so it's only second best. And I think the same goes for reform. Reform doesn't efface the moral defilement, but is only second best. And then the last reason why this really seems to be the best option is, as you say in your paper, if the victim lets herself be killed, there's no way she could possibly attend to the attacker's reform, so this is really a very uncertain option. So it seems then that the victim is more often warranted to kill than to hope for reform. And if that is really the case, then we have additional reason to kill, and we should really be clear when the victim can strike out against the attacker. And, yep. So this is my first comment, that because killing seems to be the best option, we should be really clear who should be killed. And then now I'm turning to the second question. Who needs moral assistance? When I was reading your paper, I didn't get a very clear answer who actually is in need of moral assistance. But as I said before, it's really, really crucial that we get clear on that point, since we have reason to kill those people who are in need of moral assistance. So we better get that clear. And from your paper, I understood there's a certain threshold after which somebody becomes needy of moral assistance. And I gathered that from a comment that you make on page 11. That might be an overinterpretation, but you say even if he is less needy, he is still sufficiently needy. So I gathered that would suggest there's a certain threshold after which one becomes needy of moral assistance. And on my reading of the paper, your view on moral assistance doesn't really match up with liability, and that might cause some problems, as I will now illustrate. And just to say something about the conception of liability that I'm using McMahon's classification of the types of threat, and then also his liability account. So we have different types of threats, and I will say more about that later. So just to remind you probably are all familiar with his account, McMahon says that a person is liable if she is responsible for an objectively unjustified threat. And besides liability, it introduces further considerations that determine whether, all things considered, somebody can be killed or not. So he uses this necessity requirement, which requires us to use the least harmful means to avert a threat. So that might mean even if somebody is liable to be killed, it might not be permissible to kill that person because there are less than lethal means to do so. So there could be several different ways of understanding the need for moral assistance and to understand who actually needs moral assistance. And in the paper, it wasn't really clear. As I said, there could be bits and pieces of the paper which support either view, I guess. But ultimately, reconstructing your thoughts, I think the most plausible one is the one I call the wrongful threat threshold, which is the blue line over there. But I'm going to present all of them and discuss them all and say why the wrongful threat threshold seems to be the most plausible one. So first, one could have a threshold for the need of moral assistance which is grounded on a subjectivist conception of well-being. So we could say if the attacker is likely to feel remorse or guilt or a subjective diminishment of well-being, then clearly that person is in need of moral assistance. And I think your episode, the episode of Gandhi that you present, really points out to the importance of the attacker's subjective experience. So moral defilement really manifests itself in how we feel and how we would judge our well-being. But then again, at the beginning of the paper, you rule out a thoroughly subjectivist conception of well-being, which seems only fair, because it seems if we had such subjectivist conception, then the truly evil people would be let off the hook. So those who wouldn't feel remorse or wouldn't feel the diminishment of their well-being, they simply would not be in need of moral assistance. So I think we can rule out this conception. Then the second conception that we could form about those who are in need of moral assistance is the causing death threshold. That would be the biggest group. And here we could say that the line between those who need and those who don't need moral assistance is simply to say that causing death and the moral horror attached to this is sufficient for somebody to need assistance. So causing death is certainly a traumatic experience, and that fact might suffice to explain the need for moral assistance. And in your paper, for example, you quote you quote Cecil Farber saying that killing elicits horror, or at the very least is tainted with the opprobrium which most societies cast on most acts of killing. And I think that doesn't only hold for killing, like Farber says, but probably for causing death generally. But then again, in the paper, you clearly distinguish between defensive killing and unjustified attacks. And furthermore, you really stress the importance of motivation. So our motivation to act matters. For that reason, I think causing death as such, even though it might be traumatic, is probably not the right threshold for those who need lethal moral assistance. And I would rule out that conception as well. Then a third way to think about those in need of moral assistance is to set it at the wrongful threat threshold, which is the blue line. And here one could say all those need moral assistance who pose a wrongful threat. And on McMahon's classification, that would be all those types of threat which are above the blue line, so the justified threat, non-responsible threat, innocent and excused threats, partially excused threats, and culpable threats. And the reason why I think that might be the idea that you had, or that might be the group that you actually want to exclude, is because you mentioned the examples of child soldiers, which I think McMahon puts into the group of innocent and excused threats, or partially excused, or so he's a bit unclear or unsure where to put them. And then you also mentioned classic moral dilemmas such as Jim and the Indians, where you say in these cases moral wretchedness is simply unavoidable, and they would probably fall within the category of justified threats, because even though it's a wrongful harm, they still have a justification, a lesser evil justification of doing so. So for that reason, I think that seems to be the most plausible interpretation of your view, but I will come to the problems associated with it later. Then the fourth option would be the liability threshold, and I think that would already rule out some problems. Here you could say that people in need of moral assistance are also those who are liable, so those who are morally responsible for an objectively unjustified threat. But again, as I said, since you include those moral dilemmas, like Jim and the Indians, and you also include child soldiers, it seems that the group of those in need of moral assistance is actually bigger than just the ones who are liable. And I think also if we think about the notion of moral wretchedness and well-being as being or somehow tracking psychological realities, it seems to me the group is likely to be quite big. So I think we can also rule out the liability threshold for need for moral assistance. And the fifth one, which I just want to mention because I think maybe an argument could be made out of it, even though you rule it out right from the start, is the culpability threshold. And here you say that culpability doesn't matter, or non-culpable and culpable threats are equally in need of moral assistance, so that's one that we can rule out. Okay, so that was all I had on the second point. Now I move on to the third point, the strength of the warrant, and the question, what shall we do with non-liable threats in need of moral assistance? And I have... So the problem here, I think, is if I'm right about the interpretation of your paper, then we find that those in need of moral assistance are not always liable to be killed. So we see that the red and the blue line, they do not match up. So the group of those in need of moral assistance is much bigger than the group of those who are liable. And that gives us two different advice for action. So on the one hand, we are not permitted to kill the attacker because the attacker is not liable. On the other hand, we are warranted to strike out against the attacker because he or she is in need of moral assistance. So we need to answer the question, what is the victim actually allowed to do in those cases, and what all things considered would be the right thing. And I think this is another important thing that should be clarified in order to avoid ambiguities or some problems with the paper, and a lot probably hinges on the strength of your notion of warrant. And I just briefly want to sketch three solutions that I was thinking of. And the first one is simply avoiding the question of the strength of warrant and opt for the liability threshold. So if we say all those who are liable are also in need of moral assistance, so the groups are of the same size, then we avoid the question, we don't have to weigh the strength of the warrant against other considerations. When the attacker is liable to be killed and killing her is necessary, then the victim is also warranted to kill because the attacker is needy. But I think I would not really like that solution because, as I said before, what I find appealing about your paper is that it seems to track psychological realities, or at least how I imagine them to be. And I think your Gandhi story and then other hints in your paper also point out that this is something that is important to you, or that was your ambition that to match up with psychological realities. So I think a broader notion of moral neediness is in fact the one we should go for. But then that of course poses the question, further questions. And one way might be to say, okay, below the liability threshold, maybe it's just a different kind of moral assistance that we should give. So maybe in that case, we should go up for the reform, even though it seems the second best option. Or there might be some way to respond proportionately. I don't know. And then the second way of solving this tension would be to simply say that the warrant to kill the morally needy is a defeated reason. So in a footnote, you explain what you mean by warrant, and that I wasn't so really sure how strong the notion of warrant is, but you say that warrant is weaker than being justified. Justified meaning acting on undefeated reasons. So if somebody's warranted, that means he or she attends to genuine moral reasons and does something morally acceptable. But so the need for moral assistance provides us with genuine moral reasons. but this reason is defeated by the fact that the attacker is not liable. So you give another example of when the warrant to kill is defeated and you say nobody can actually be required to kill somebody. So this reason would defeat the warrant to attend to the needs of the attacker. And one could say, okay, then the non-liability of the attacker is another such defeating reason. So in that case, moral assistance would always be tied up with liability, even though both don't have the same extension. And that might probably be the best way to understand your idea of warrant. But then I had a further question if that was indeed the solution, because it seems if this moral assistance is another independent reason, it might tip the balance in borderline cases. So we have the case of the innocent or excused threat, where McMahon says they are not culpable and they are only liable to a diminished degree. And here, the victim would be required to take more risk on herself or to use less than lethal means as a matter of proportionality. And so my question would be, if we add this other reason that the attacker is in need of moral assistance, is then does that kind of push it up to full liability, for example? So are they also allowed to kill then the innocent and the excused, who were formerly only liable to a diminished degree? And I'm not so sure about that. And then I move on to my last suggestion, that would be to say we have strong independent reasons for action, and this warrant is actually such a strong independent reason, possibly on par with lesser evil justifications. And in that case, the victim is warranted to kill in self-defense not only when the attacker is liable, but also when the attacker needs moral assistance. So all threats above the blue line can be killed, so to say. But I suspect that that would lead very quickly on a slippery slope, especially in combination with the idea that sometimes it's better to be dead than to be morally defiled, and that might be problematic, or that might be a consequence that we're not willing to accept. So I think, and then furthermore, I think that this last solution wouldn't really fit your definition of warrant very well, because I got the impression that moral warrant is often or regularly overridden by other considerations. Yeah, so these were all my comments, and now I'm looking forward to hearing what you have to say.
Thank you, so that was super, very, very pressing. And just a quick thank you to Jonathan and to Helen for the invitation to be. This is my first ELAC conference, so it's very nice to come to Stockholm for this. And I also should issue an apology that it's my first attempt at a paper on defense of harm. I don't work on just war theory, and my footnotes were sort of a fledgling attempt to catch up with the literature. And be forceful, but also gentle in questions, because I'm not immersed in the debates. By way of reply, Lisa jumped in where I feared to tread, and that was in the answering the all things considered question. My ambition was only to try to get on the table the idea that pro tanto we have a duty to attend to the needs of the attacker. So that felt like a big enough mouthful, a big enough bite to chew on. Even though, in thinking in defense of harm cases about the needs of the attacker as an interested party, that was all my ambition. So I'm glad to be pressed to look at the all things considered question. I don't have very good answers on it, but I'll do my best. And also just to acknowledge that with the point on my interpretation of revisionist just war theory, I think, yeah, you're right, I should have been more careful. I might actually have a few more allies in revisionist just war theory than I thought. I think one thing I was interested in was that you thought, when we're looking at, focusing on the tough case of when we're going to have to kill the attacker in order to prevent the attack from carrying out an unjustified act of lethal aggression, that we've got these two options. We're both imperfect. We can either kill or we can allow ourselves or the victim to be killed. And you thought that the ex ante option was the more preferable, or that there were more arguments you could make for it. Because when I've spoken to some other people, I was talking to Fabian Peter and I was talking to Michael as well, that there seemed to be a preference there for the ex post option, that the very attempt to argue that lethal force could be assistive, that was going to be a hard sell. Fabien said, you know, when you kill someone, you deny them the opportunity to repair, reform, to grow morally, to flourish. That there's really hard to argue for the ex ante option. So it was nice to hear some arguments in support of it. And I think you may be right that whether the ex ante or the ex post option seems the more preferable will depend to some extent on the culpability of the attacker, and that in cases where the attacker is non-culpable, like a child soldier, we might think they're, you know, the victim, if they're a competent victim, they have a responsibility to accept more risk on themselves and possibly to allow themselves to be killed rather than to kill in the name of assistance a child soldier who's not culpable. So I want to think that through more carefully, but I think both the ex ante and the ex post, there's something to be said for either option. I think the reason that they're imperfect and the reason I didn't want to go the whole way and say there's a duty to act defensively is because it's asking a lot of the victim, that you become a killer, in particular you become a killer of a non-culpable aggressor in the name of moral assistance. So I need to flesh that out more. With respect to where to place the threshold on who counts as morally needy, I think broadly I'd agree with you that it goes where McMahon puts wrongful threats. I had actually thought it went there, not here. And I think I might have misused Jim and the Indians and some of the other moral dilemmas if I implied that it would be morally, that sort of the most morally assistive thing to do for Jim would be to shoot Jim before Jim shoots any of the 19 Indians who are lined up to be killed by Pedro, unless Jim acts. Because if you shoot Jim, in one sense, sure, you've prevented Jim from having to carry out this horrible act, but the horrible act issue hasn't gone away. There's still Pedro and the 19 Indians against the wall are there, and someone's going to have to address the situation. So if in fact Jim's justified, then he wasn't the kind of person I was thinking about in this analysis. It was the people who haven't got a moral argument for why they were about to do what they were going to do. Jim has a moral argument that he has a lesser evil justification. So it was the non-responsible, the excused, and excused, I think, are going to be tricky for me as well. That when someone's in a way, excused cases are just sort of the most morally tragic. That you have reasons to believe that you have reasons to act this way. That sort of you've done the best you could, as sort of a faulty reasoning agent with the information you had and your abilities to address the situation, and so you're morally needy in that you're about to do something horrible that's not justified, but there I've got sort of competing intuitions on sort of what's the most morally useful and supportive thing to do for you, and killing you to prevent you from doing something excused, also seems like that's going to be a hard thing to defend. I think in general I was of putting the line there rather than unjustified. Let's see, other things I wanted to say in response. I think you're right that in many cases it's quite possible the reason or the duty will be defeated. That there'll be so many other considerations that have to be taken into account, and that will be very weighty. So defending your own life is a very weighty consideration. And so the duty to protect your own life, the duty to protect the victim's life, that will be operative in any of these scenarios. And so we might think, okay, well, the duty to assist the attacker by preventing him from doing this horrible thing and, you know, thereby killing him, that's just gravy. It just gives us an extra little bit of a reason. It's not going to be determinative. And that's probably true. I think where it's interesting is the cases where it seems like where those other considerations aren't in play. So, and that's why I focused on suicidal victim or the case, the terminally ill victim, where the victim has no interest in having their life protected. That then we have to focus on that gravy. We have to look at, okay, no, the interests of the attacker matter here as well, and they're going to be determinative in terms of how we have to act. So I think that's where I just sort of wanted to insert the attacker in the analysis of how we should behave, and to push back on McMahon's claim that moral defilement isn't going to be something we should give a lot of attention to. You know, that if you've got a bad event, or sort of, you know, a bad event plus a broken leg, and an evil event, you'd be perverse to prevent the evil event. Well, that if you say that, you're ignoring that there are two people. You're ignoring the interests of the attacker. So that was really my aim, was to get the attacker on the table as a party. But there was so much more in what you said, and I haven't done justice to it. So, you know, either you can press me on Lisa's behalf, or you can press me more, and we can talk afterward. Thank you for your comments.
Thank you.